I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Culture Map presents What's Eric Eating? From the Gal Media Studios in Houston, Texas, here's Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler. I have Aaron Bludorn from Bludorn's coming up in a little bit. But first, I'm joined by my co-host this week. He is a passionate advocate for the Houston food scene, Matt Harris. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm doing okay, sir.
So, Matt, before we dive into the news of the week, I did want to note just very briefly that this is episode 150 of this particular podcast. We've been at this for a little over 3 years now. It's kind of astonishing to me. I didn't know when I sat down and sort of pitched this idea to some of my Gal Media colleagues that it would still be happening 3 years and 150 episodes later. But I just want to take this opportunity to thank the listeners who have given this podcast an audience and make it viable. And you know, whenever I'm out in public, it seems like somebody inevitably comes up to me and says, you know, how much they like the show or how much they, you know, how much value they get from it, which is great. And then there's all the people behind the scenes, you and the other co-hosts, Felice Sloan, Rebecca Masson, Linda Salinas, Mary Clarkson, and of course, our beloved producer, Michael Carroll, who I don't think has ever actually spoken on the podcast.
That is correct, sir.
But you can tell when things are really rolling because you will occasionally hear him chuckle.
Indeed, this obviously would have been a great place for my, you know, what happened before episode 150 joke.
That's debatable.
No time. All right. But no.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your part in that. And really, it really is the listeners who make this worth doing. And I think I shared this once. I was walking to the farmer's market a few months ago, and a guy rolls down his window and goes, "Hey, I'm listening to your podcast right now." It's like, that always feels good. And I'm just so happy that people have made it part of their routine. So let us move on. Let us dive right into the news of the week. Topic number one. The past week has been a tough one for restaurants closing after one or more employees have tested positive for the coronavirus. Just, I mean, Brennan's, Riel, El Topo, Rosie Cannonball, Mad. And then there's restaurants that didn't have someone test positive, but Cata Robata had an employee test positive for antibodies, which means that at some point during the pandemic, they had the disease. So out of an abundance of caution, they decided to test everybody and make sure everybody was healthy. Cultivari did the same thing. I talked to Tony Lerman from El Topo. One of their cooks lives with his family. Other people that he lives with had contact with someone who tested positive. So out of an abundance of caution, and you know, they canceled service for the weekend. It's scary out there. It feels like the virus is making its way through Houston, maybe in a way that it hadn't previously.
Yeah, it's tough. It's really challenging right now. It's been really challenging. You know, it's a little. I don't know. It's hard to draw any real conclusion. So there's a sense of, you know, now it's just every positive case is this, you know, we're one step closer to, you know, impending doom. I don't know.
Well,
it's also confusing.
Right. I mean, I share kind of your confusion in the sense that, you know, younger people are getting the disease, they are better able to sort of survive it. So, you know, the case rate, the hospitalization rate has gone up, or the number of people hospitalized with the disease has gone up, but the number of deaths is for Harris County is still very low. I mean, it's fewer than 400 as of Monday when we're recording this podcast. And I guess there's a whole bunch of sort of factors, and I've talked about some of them over the past couple of weeks, but, you know, the Houston Chronicle had an article last week that, you know, restaurants they're not required to disclose this information, and they're not even required to close, although that does seem to be the standard response. I mean, do you have an opinion about whether restaurants should disclose and should close when an employee tests positive?
Well, I will say, on the general, I'm a big fan of transparency. I think that's the best way to respond to this and most things, certainly within this sort of category of public health. Closing, I'm not sure. That's not for me to answer. I would leave that up to the establishments to decide, and then I'll decide if I'm going to patronize or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things about these recent closings is that it's touching places that I have eaten at, right? You and I have both been to Kata Robata since it reopened for dine-in, and I felt very good about their practices in terms of spacing the tables far apart, having hand sanitizer available when you walk in, having employees who wore masks and gloves and, you know, single-use condiments and all that stuff. I felt like they were taking those practices very seriously, and that made me feel comfortable dining there. And so it's frustrating is the wrong word, but it just, you know, it's just I'm not sure what the right word is, to be honest with you. When it seems like a restaurant is doing everything that they can, and this, they're still getting touched by this, it's, you know, it just sort of goes to the extent that the, you know, the virus is kind of on its own timeline, I guess.
No, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think there's a proportionality sort of across the board with a lot of this. You know, swine flu about 10 years ago, you know, we had 60 million cases in the U.S. So it's just, you know, I realize this is a different virus. There have been, you know, a number of deaths, not here locally, but these are, life is a series of calculations of risk and rewards. This movement towards every positive case sort of being the end all be all is to me very dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that we do have to kind of live with the reality of the virus, and so I'm glad that businesses are now required to mandate that people inside them wear masks. I think, you know, everything that I've read suggests that masks are a key component of allowing people to gather in spaces and help prevent the spread of the disease. So, you know, I think that that's all to the good. I know it's less practical at restaurants, but you know, once you're seated at the table, you can take your mask off. You're, again, you'll be far enough apart from other people. But, you know, as you're moving around the restaurant, entering, leaving, going to the restroom, that sort of thing, you know, I think the masks are a reasonable safety precaution. We've talked about that before. You know, I think I said it's a courtesy we extend to each other.
Totally agree. And again, you know, we can put this under the confusing aspects of this, you know, whole COVID is how masks became the flashpoint of it. It just is, will probably be one of life's great mysteries. I just can't understand the challenge that someone has with wearing a mask in public. So,
no, I mean, I agree with you. I wear a mask anytime I'm in a public place. Not when I walk my dogs and I'm outside and I'm far apart from people, but if I go to a restaurant or a grocery store, I went to Target last week with a mask on, you know, any of that kind of environment. Hopefully everyone listens to this is wearing a mask in similar settings. Now, of course, if you're in Harris County, you're legally required to. So, you know, hopefully that helps slow some of the spread of this.
Right. And the flip side being, you know, if I go out in public, you know, I'm not some grandma killer who, you know, wants to intentionally, you know, infect the public. It's just.
Right. Yeah. We could all do with dialing down the rhetoric a little bit.
There you go.
All right. Let me move on to topic number two, because this is a big deal. Johnny Rhodes announced on Instagram that he will close Indigo in July of 2021. Indigo is the neo soul food restaurant, a tasting menu restaurant in North Houston that has been an absolute phenomenon since it opened in 2018. I was going back through it. It made best new restaurant lists from Texas Monthly, GQ, Food and Wine, Eater. Johnny got a James Beard nomination, a semifinalist nomination for his work there as a rising a best new chef or a rising star chef. And Time Magazine named it one of the places to go in 2019. I mean, it's just one of those, like, you know, a little high fidelity, right? To talk about musicians, is it better to burn out or fade away? Indigo is definitely going to burn out. It's not going to fade away.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think, and Johnny alluded this in his post or several posts here recently. I think the dream has always been bigger for him. And, you know, to me, you know, personally, that's exciting. I've learned a lot and feel fortunate to have spent time at Indigo and learned from more about the vision, if you will. You know, Brougham Groceries, which just opened during all this pandemic stuff, is already on my regular rotation. So a little sad that Indigo's closing, but that's momentary and a little bit selfish. And I think if I had to sum it up in one word, it would be excitement.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on kind of what I want to dive into, which is that, you know, in the Instagram post, he sort of says that the plan is to really focus on Brougham Soul Food Grocery, the grocery store he opened in Indigo in April, and to extend its mission by building out a farm. And he has secured that farmland, and they have already begun kind of clearing the woods so that it will be able to be farmed and will be productive. And he's going to bring, you know, everything that he's doing at Brougham into a bigger, better space with just more. And I, you know, I know he feels that sense of mission to kind of bring, I mean, real food, not packaged, not processed, you know, nutritious food, to that Lyndale Park, Trinity Grove kind of section of Houston. And, you know, I think at this point, really all we can do is kind of enjoy this last year of Indigo. I mean, I'm certainly, you know, looking at the calendar, trying to figure out, you know, how quickly I can get in there. And then, you know, I'll probably make at least one more visit in 2021 before it goes away. And then just support, you know, Broham and I believe it's called Food Fight Farms.
Yes, sir. You know, and it's a big vision, and I would not a word that I would use very often, but you know, it's a potential game changer, and hats off to him for taking on the challenge.
Matt, I think you mentioned that you've been out there to see the farm. I mean, do you have a sense of kind of what's in store?
I think it's just the beginning, and I do have a little bit of a sense, just fortunate to have a little insight in Johnny's vision. So it's a long-term vision, you know, those things take work. So
fair enough. I saw they've started a GoFundMe. They want to raise about $250,000. I wish them a lot of luck in that. That's a big lift, but he's got a big platform. So, and he's come, you know, I mean, I think about him showing me that location in 2016 when he and his wife Shauna first signed that lease. I think about the meal that he served me and Phaedra Cook in his apartment in 2015. And I, you know, this is, you know, to go back to the music analogy, this is like, you know, this is like seeing the Beatles in Berlin. It's like you never would have imagined they would become the most famous band in the world. It's like I never would have guessed, you know, at those very early meetings that it would become so acclaimed and become such a phenomenon. But, you know, the elements were there. You could kind of see the bones of the thing, and that Johnny was so passionate and had a really clear vision for what he wanted to accomplish. And then just, you know, it's sort of good luck that the rest of the world embraced it.
Right. I think from the very initial visit, you know, the passion was what came through, and you could see, and the food as well. You know, let's not forget, you know, the food has to stand up, and it did. And when you combine that, the story, the vision, the passion with the food, you had, you know, something that was really compelling.
Absolutely. All right. And let us, topic number three, Pappas Restaurants, one of Houston's most prominent restaurant groups, closed 5 locations, including 3 inside the Loop and 1 in the Galleria. Yaya Mary's, their Greek concept, Pappas Shrimp Shack down in the 45 South and 610, Papa Dough on Richmond in the Upper Kirby area, and the Little Pappas Seafood on Shepherd Drive. I think what's unusual is that, you know, Pappas is so prominent and so successful, they don't typically close restaurants, so this does give us some sense of kind of what's going on in terms of the economic prospects for restaurants. And you know, I at the prompting of our good friend Michael Fulmer, I went into HCAD and looked these properties up. The company actually owns the land for all of these, so this is not a lease situation where they're moving on from buildings they don't own. This is their dirt. Matt, what do you make of this decision, and is there any one of these in particular that you're going to miss?
I think it speaks to the reality of where we are present day. You know, if Papa's was going to close any locations, I guess, you know, if these would probably be, someone said, which ones do you think will close? I would probably mention a few of these. But they're a big group. They're very successful. Certainly, they don't need any advice from me. You know, I do. We had a pretty good meal at Yaya Mary's right before all this COVID started. So that that's a nice little memory, and life will go on, and Pappas will be fine. And
yeah, don't shed too many tears for Pappas, right? They do just fine. I'm with you. Yaya Mary's was a restaurant that I have only sort of come to appreciate in the last couple of years, but you know, those lamb chops, those mixed grill platters, all the little Greek touches that they kind of put into that place. I think that was kind of a special restaurant. And of course, you know, Little Pappas, you know, just a really comfortable place when you know, it seems like they were always running like super affordable specials on raw oysters, or you could get like a platter of really expertly fried Gulf Coast seafood. I mean, not that it was ever cheap, but the company is certainly known for its portions, and so you were not going to leave hungry no matter what. So
those two
kind of stand out for me.
Yes, sir. You know, and that little Pappas is right in the neighborhood, and that's also where they would trot out some of their R&D dishes, which was, you know, always kind of fun. And a fair number of visits there, just going into the bar area, sitting at a cocktail table and having some oysters, and yeah, good times.
Absolutely. All right, Matt, that does it for the news of the week. We'll be right back with our restaurants of the week. Stick around.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
So, Matt, for our restaurants of the week, I want to talk to you about a couple of new places in the Heights. The first is Bibor Pacific. This is the Filipino restaurant. It started in Austin and came to Houston. That Austin location actually recently closed, so it is now a solely Houston concept. Matt, I'm just going to sort of throw it to you. What did you think of our meal at Bibor Pacific?
That's a little nugget of news for me. I didn't realize their Austin location had closed. It was one visit. I think with everything that's going on, I probably need to go back one or two more times to get a more informed opinion.
Yeah, I'm with you in the sense that I had kind of high expectations. I've heard a lot of good things about it, both from friends in Austin and people in Houston who have tried it, and I don't feel like we caught it on its best day. You know, we got the sweet chili wings that, you know, maybe didn't have enough sweet chili sauce on them. You know, I like the Filipino barbecue, which is that kind of Korean style cross-cut short rib with some pickled onions, and I like the shrimp and pork lumpia, the little egg rolls. But yeah, there's just something about a couple of dishes that just came up a little bit short.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. Again, you know, one visit, kind of mid-afternoon. You know, I'm certainly willing to go back. It's
I guess the biggest flaw was, you know, we had that bacon fried rice, and it wasn't like hot enough in temperature, which is just never a good sign. It just means the kitchen maybe isn't quite firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, I did enjoy the texture on that rice quite a bit, but it was off temp a little. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I don't want to dwell. I mean, I think we'll give Bibor Pacific another shot here in a few weeks, and I hope to catch it at a better version of itself. I do want to just briefly talk to you about Tenfold Coffee. This is the new shop that opened up kind of behind Johnny's Gold Brick on Yale Street, owned by Jacob Ibarra, who has worked in both Seattle and Melbourne, arguably two of the world's most coffee-obsessed cities. He has purchased coffee all over the world in various capacities, and so he's bringing all of that expertise back home. Matt, I know you've been up to Tenfold a couple of times. What did you think of the new Heights coffee shop?
You know, I had a pretty outstanding pour over there day one. Really liked everything about it. Liked the space, liked the setup, really liked my pour over. Jacob was there, got to talk to him for a little bit, and you know, he's got a great reputation, both locally, nationally, and internationally. And I think it's great news for Houston and great news for coffee drinkers.
Right. I agree with you. I mean, you know, he introduced me to a pour over with a coffee from Ecuador. And, you know, when he says, oh, you know, I got it from this farm, he knows the farmer. And I know that that's not unique. I mean, I know David Buer travels to buy coffee beans. I know Max Gonzalez from Catalina and Amaya travels to buy coffee beans. So I'm not saying that it's necessarily unique, but I'm saying that when a coffee roaster, a coffee buyer has a personal relationship with the coffee farmer, I think that's good for us as consumers, and more of that is a good thing.
Agreed. And this is big news in the coffee world for Houston.
Yeah. Yeah, anytime someone with kind of Jacob's expertise and experience, it would be like, well, you know, I'm going to talk to Aaron Bluedorn, you know, who's worked in a world-class restaurant in New York. Anytime someone with that level of expertise decides to open a business, it just makes everyone step their game up just a little bit.
Daddy, that's what we call a segue.
Yeah, you know what? I think we're gonna wrap it up right there. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll be right back with Aaron Bluedorn.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
I am joined this week by Aaron Bluedorn. He is opening a restaurant in Montrose, conveniently called Bluedorn's, later this year. Aaron, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for having me, Eric.
Thanks for doing this. You know, I always like to kind of start these interviews at the beginning. Can you tell me a little bit about kind of how you became interested in being a chef and kind of what your career was like?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually the only real job I've ever held is working in a kitchen. I started off at a little greasy spoon on Bainbridge Island in Washington, where I grew up, called the Streamliner Diner, at the age of 16. There, I was a dishwasher prep cook, and you know, it was funny. I never found another job or a place where I felt more at home than the kitchen. And it just, you know, whatever I did after that. So anyway, I got my start there. Tried to go to real college at Humboldt State. That didn't work out so well. I wasn't as interested in things that I felt like I wasn't going to be using later on in life, and I just found more practicality in the kitchen. I worked at when I was there. I mean, if you know anything about our California, it's kind of like the hippie capital of the United States. I started off as a dishwasher at a vegetarian restaurant, and moved my way up and ended up running the kitchen at the age of 20, and then realized that I needed to get serious about it and go to culinary school. So went to the CIA and, you know, caught the bug, and the rest is history. So.
Right. So, I mean, obviously you've been sort of most prominently associated with your time at Cafe Ballou. You were the executive chef there for 6 years. What was that like? I mean, it's a high profile place. Obviously Daniel Ballou, one of the most famous French chefs in America. I mean, yeah, I know this sounds sort of silly, but what was it like kind of working in such a high profile environment?
I mean, it was daunting. It was, you know, every day walking in, I felt like I had my stomach in my throat. I was nervous. Especially at the beginning, you know, that's a tough, you got big shoes to fill. You've got, you know, lots of, there's plenty of visibility for the rest of the city, you know, and arguably the rest of the country too. And working for Danielle is you want to live up to his expectations, and it was very nerve-wracking, but that's what makes you better, and that's what continued to push me every day. Was I knew I had to live up to it and do more. And it's not just living up to what everyone's done in the past, you know, from Andrew Carmelini to Gavin Kaysen to Bertrand Chamel. They've all left their mark on that restaurant, and it was, I felt like I had to do the same thing. And that's, I constantly thought, how am I going to make this restaurant better than I received it as a chef? So
what would you say were maybe the one or two things you're the most proud of in terms of leaving your mark on the place?
I would say that we established these voyage dinners that I was doing probably about once a season, and where we would invite a chef from the region of cuisine that we were going to focus on in that menu. Now, let me backtrack a little bit. The menu at Cafe Balude for the whole 20 years that it's been open has had, it's been the same format where it's four different muses of Danielle's, and each, so there's La Tradition, the Saison, Protégé, and Voyage. And the Voyage section was a place where we would explore a different cuisine from around the world. Now, I was very conscious of the fact that that looked like cultural appropriation, which scared the living daylights out of me. And especially, you know, I knew that if we got reviewed or if anyone kind of caught wind that we were still doing that, there better had been a pretty good reason behind behind why we chose that style of food. And where did we learn? Did we just pick up a cookbook, or did we go do the time and due diligence? And so I decided that it was important for me to set up these dinners where we'd invite these chefs and we'd have these collaborations. And I, you know, of course, getting Danielle excited about something like that wasn't very hard. But so we had a blast. Some of my were we had Pierre Chom, the Senegalese chef, come in and cook a dinner with us, and to find the similarities between French cuisine, American cuisine, and Senegalese cuisine isn't as hard as you think. There are so many similarities, and it was fun to experience that. And actually, our GM at the time at Cafe was a man by the name of Sharif Mabouj, and he will actually be our GM at Blue Dorn as well. And it was fun for him to be involved in that, and we really had a blast. But you know, all those dinners were something that I really felt strongly about. And I think as well, bringing more of the green Union Square Green Market to Cafe Balude was something I did a lot of. And not to say the chefs didn't do it in the past, but we really incorporated a lot of that into the menu at Cafe Balude by featuring those farms and such, and getting the opportunity to go visit the farms and, you know, cook with the farmers and then bring that food back to New York was also something I was very proud of. So
yeah, no, that I mean, those are great answers to that question. How did you all right, so you grew up on the West Coast, you worked in New York. How did you make the decision that when it was time to step out on your own that you were coming to Houston?
So I'd gotten married. I met my wife working at a cafe. She was working for the main office for Danielle. And, you know, it was just one of those things where, you know, as chefs, as much as, you know, everyone kind of labels us party animals or whatnot, we don't really have time to go out that much. If you're serious about your craft and trying to keep water, you're at the restaurant all the time. So, but anyway, so I fell in love with someone who I work with. But anyway, then, you know, of course, what you do and when you get married, right, you start making plans and where are we going to raise a family and what makes the most sense. And, you know, this had always been a goal of mine to open a restaurant, and that had to factor into it. And again, it goes down to the reality, well, are we going to go somewhere where we don't know anyone and have no family and have no support system and just open a restaurant out of the blue? Or are we going to put our roots down somewhere where we want to, you know, where we want to raise a family? And the more I had been traveling here, I got to know the local chefs. I got to eat around the city. And I just fell in love with Houston and its dining scene. I didn't feel like I would be opening a restaurant to necessarily fill a gap, but I would rather want to open a restaurant where I could add to it and be able to play, you know, whatever small role I can in the restaurant community here. And I just felt like this was such a great fit for what I wanted to do. So
how long into your getting to know your now wife did it take for her to sort of explain that she's part of restaurant royalty in Houston?
Well, that's actually a really funny story. So I had no clue. I was like, oh, she's Greek. Her family owns a few Greek diners here down in Houston, whatever. You know, I kind of wrote it off and wasn't really focused on that. And she is very modest, and especially in New York. You know, I'd never been to Houston before. I probably had never even dreamed of living there at the time. And she was like, oh, yeah, you know, you'll enjoy talking to my father. You know, he's been doing this his whole life. But, you know, again, I had this picture of my big fat Greek wedding, and that's what I was getting into. And then we go to a wedding in Austin, and her dad looks at me and goes, hey, come on, let's get out of here. Let's go play show and tell, as he said. And I was just blown away. I remember coming back to the hotel after, you know, Victoria had been doing her bridesmaid things and saying, you did not tell me the magnitude of it. I don't even think I realized it. I actually came to Houston and did a tour of the warehouses. And I mean, the thing that stood out to me was all of his employees had worked for him for 20 plus years. And those were the ones that were like the junior.
Yeah. They don't really leave. Yeah.
So much for those small Greek diners.
Yeah, it's a little more ambitious than that. It's a little more successful than that.
Yeah, I know, but you know, so.
All right, so you're opening in the former Passive Provision space on Taft. How did you kind of settle on that, and what do you think your plans are in terms of what the space is going to look like?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd love to show it to you someday, Eric. Once we get all finished, you know, I'll give you a little pre-tour. But so it wasn't my first space. You know, I think it was reported on, and it's very true that we were looking at the Black Lab. And I was looking for a standalone restaurant here in Houston that would be, you know, large enough for about 100-seat dining room, and a private dining room and then a bar. And hopefully some outdoor area. And the Black Lab seemed to have all the right fittings. It's just, at the end of the day, it's such a beautiful space. It's such a beautiful setting. It just didn't work out. And, you know, it would have taken a lot of work, just like we've done here at 807 Taft. But I think after that deal started to get a little bit shaky, this had always been in the back of my mind as being an option. And once we started looking at what we wanted to do in the space and kind of lived in, you know, taking a few drives around Houston, I really was excited to land here, because we've been able to create ambiance inside the building that kind of echoes what is outside to a certain extent. Like, as the, you know, the design is we wanted it to be timeless, but appropriate to the age of the building, which is somewhere in the 30s and 40s. It's funny, if you look at the building was initially one building, right? And then there was another building, and then they built one piece to put the two together. And so a lot of our design has kind of followed that path to to do justice to this, you know, I think it's a pretty stunning building out here in the middle of the Fourth Ward that was built mid-century. Now, not only did it have past, right? It had they had Gravitas, and then, you know, of course, Anton's before that, and just all that history to be. And it's not one of those, you know, I know in real estate people will talk about snake bitten properties where, you know, a restaurant's gone in and hasn't done so well. Those three restaurants have been amazing. So there's something in the water over here, and I wanted to be a part of it. So.
Well, good. So how's the construction coming along? I mean, do you have a rough timeline at this point for when you'd like to open?
You know, we do. And I'll just, we're looking to finish up construction in the next month, and mid-August is what we're gearing towards. I wish I could have an opening date that I could announce, but with the pandemic and everything that's going on, I just want to be, well, I think we'll feel better about it in a month to announce it then, the actual date, but we could say mid-August, you know.
All right, and then tell me a little about the food. I mean, you know, it's sort of an open question, is, you know, how French, how American, like, how do you see the menu coming together?
I call it American. I think I would be completely remiss if I was to say that there was no French influence. I think from Café Bleu to Cyrus to Canlis, the restaurants that I've been in have all been rooted in French technique, you know, and you can't get away from that. You're always going to gravitate towards that. However, I didn't want to come down to Texas and cook the food I was cooking in New York. That didn't appeal to me as much. We have to be, you know, I have to realize where I am, and give credit to what's around here, but, you know, give it my own take, and how I see food is going to be much different than I think other chefs that have had experiences that may have been more around here. But to me, it's all about the ingredients and sort of chasing after what the Gulf has to offer, what Texas, Louisiana, farms from all over have to bring. You know, I'm going to be cooking, I'm going to be having tomato dishes in the middle of December, which is wild for me, but I'm going to get used to it. We always do. I think there's going to be a big emphasis on Gulf seafood with oysters playing a big role. We have a 8-seat oyster bar with a live oyster, you know, I guess, what do you call it, an aquarium or a presentation with the ice and everything, so we can have that front and center. I mean, oysters have always been a passion of mine from having them in Seattle, which I think they're fantastic there, to having East Coast oysters out on the Cape or in Long Island or wherever out east. And then down here, Gulf oysters are, you know, to tell you the truth, I've been really impressed with some of these smaller farms. The more trips I take down here, it's not the big old Gulf oyster, which you're used to when you go to New Orleans and having, you know, what was it, 25-cent oysters or something. They're really getting a lot better. You know, the Murder Point, just to name one off the top of my head. But we plan on doing a little trip to visit all those farms that we plan on sourcing from, hopefully before we open. So I think other, you know, I've divided the menu. I can talk a little bit more about it. Like, I think I'll always have a foie gras dish on the menu as long as it stays legal in Texas, but I don't think we have a problem there.
I don't think we're that kind of state. I think you're safe there.
That's good. You know, free the foie gras. I think, you know, looking at the menu, there will be a raw bar. There will be, an option to have the seafood tower, but my options might not be as traditional. Although if you want it traditional, we can do it there as well. I think lots of vegetables. I've always cooked with a lot of vegetables and showing, you know, and taking an ingredient and looking at it and finding out what is the the right way to treat it, whether it's very delicately and not that much at all, or do we want to put, some side, I don't know. I think about asparagus. I guess that was the last one when I saw it at the grocery store. I think I want to serve it with a Grabiche sauce or something like that, which is very French, but to me that can also be very American too. I think we will have pastas on the menu. I think every restaurant I've cooked in the last 15 years has had a fresh pasta program, and that will certainly play a role as well. But then, using, to go back to what I was talking about, using local ingredients, if we're using a lump crab in a fettuccine dish, that to me is a way for us to have fun with what we have around us. So, and I also like to say there will be plenty of meat options available as well. Whether it's lamb, duck, chicken, those are dishes that I, those are meats that I really enjoy playing with and having a lot of fun, within the season that you're in. And I think the ability to add, crawfish to a chicken dish is something I did in New York, and people looked at me like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, this is a dish that Danielle taught me. And then I come down here, and it's so much fun to see how Gulf cuisine, relies on Cajun roots and how that actually came from French cuisine. And if you bring that all together, where are you? We're all same planet. So not to get too existential there, but
yeah, you won't have to explain what crawfish are to people here. So we've got a pretty good grasp on well, all forms of shellfish. I mean, I think that's one of the great bounties of the Gulf: the oysters, the crabs, the shrimp.
Agreed, totally agreed, and something I'm really excited about. You know what? Also, is really cool is the bycatches you can get out of the Gulf. It's not just. You don't just have red snapper. Like my brother-in-law went fishing and brought back some kingfish, and I was really excited about it. He was like, what do you do with the kingfish? I'm like, well, you pretty much anything you do with a mackerel, except it doesn't break down as fast as a mackerel can, and you can have so much fun with it. I mean, you can do kingfish in like an escabeche or something like that, or you can do a seared kingfish or a kingfish pokey. I don't know. I had a blast just playing with this fish that, he might not have been, it might not have been a grouper or a redfish, but I mean, that's the kind of thing that gets me really excited. Are all these different, species of whatever.
Well, right. And there's always that. So that's always that fun kind of daily special possibility where, a purveyor gets you something off the boat, and then it goes on the menu that night.
Absolutely. And I think that's you keep your cell phone next to you at night, and I can tell you that it's been more than once that buzzes, and it's a purveyor at 1 a.m. saying, "Hey, Aaron, I've got this beautiful turbo we got in," or "Hey, we're fishing John Dory off the coast of off George's Bank. You want to bring him into the restaurant tomorrow?" And it's like, "Oh yeah, let's go." And then it gets there, and you look at your sous chefs. You, well, what are we gonna do with it? What are we having to walk in? What do we pick up from the market today? And that to me is what's so exciting about being a chef is being able to play with those ingredients, have like sort of a challenge for a second, but then make it something really amazing for guests to enjoy.
Yeah, you mentioned your general manager, Sharif.
Oh yes.
Did I mispronounce that? I'm sorry.
No, you named it. Yeah, I did. Sorry. I just get excited.
Oh, good. Could you just tell me a little bit about him? Because I mean, obviously he's coming. He's coming here from New York too. So kind of what made that seem like the right choice?
So Sharif and I got to know each other when I first became the chef at Cafe Balloud, and he was just getting hired on as the general manager at the time. He's from Senegal originally, came over on a scholarship for Western Michigan to play soccer and or football, probably And he ended up falling in love and staying. He moved to New York City, worked in hospitality, did 8 years at Boulay as a server, as a captain. And if anyone knows, getting yelled at by is no small feat, and doing it for 8 years is practically incredible. He just has the hospitality gene in him through and through. He is a warm, gentle guy, but understands at every step what the guest needs and puts himself out there for it. And you know, that to me is a huge part of this restaurant, is our hospitality. And I think that there is so much hospitality in this city that we have to live up to, that I needed someone who I trusted right off the bat to jump into this with me. And, you know, thankfully he said yes when I asked him about 6 months ago. And we've made this dream of mine, this dream of ours, and which I'm just humbled and honored by. So it's pretty cool.
No, that's awesome. No, I know Matt's met him a couple of times and has a lot of good things to say about him.
Yeah, he's something else. So I'm really excited to see him here in Houston, and he's excited to be here too. So
can I just ask you about the name of the restaurant? I mean, you're naming it Bluedorn.
Yeah.
Did you think about not naming it after yourself, or how did you sort of settle on that?
I fought it with every inch of my. No. I consider myself to be pretty humble, but everybody kept telling me, you know, you gotta name it Bluedorn. You know what? Nah, didn't seem like it was right. And then we've been working with this design firm in Austin, Foda. Jet Butler is the principal, and he's done. They did all the McGuire Mormon restaurants, and you know, the list goes on. They have a pretty incredible resume. We picked them. Actually, my friend James Kent from New York used them for his last restaurant, Crown Shy, and I just really love the work that they did. And so we start talking to them, and I had some other ideas of names, and they're like, you know, your last name is one of a kind. It's beautiful. No, I can't do it. And they just kept, along with my wife too. I guess when you don't live with a name your whole life, makes it easier. So, but what really sold it was when they did a mock-up, a word mark or logo. It was just, I felt like there was nothing else I could go with, and it makes sense, you know. And if you're gonna push all your chips in, you might as well put your name on in there too. So.
Very good. All right. Well, so I do have just a couple more topics I want to hit with you. You know, obviously you mentioned Gavin Kaysen, who was your predecessor at Cafe Ballou. He went on to do some pretty special things in Minneapolis with Spoon and Stable. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you feel like there are sort of similar expectations, or do you have maybe similar expectations for yourself in terms of what you hope to accomplish here in Houston?
Well, if I accomplish what he has accomplished in Minneapolis, I will be more than excited. And I mean, I mean, expectations, yeah. Probably, I'm sure they're out there. I'm trying to look at it as this is, I'm gonna do this in my own way. While he is a mentor of mine, and I spent the last 10 years arguably, you know, in his footsteps or trying to create my own. I think that's learning how to create my own identity at Cafe Ballou will be the same thing I'll be looking to do as in opening up Bluedorn here in Houston. And you know, Houston's different than Minneapolis, but they both cities have very passionate hospitality professionals working on them. Very, you know, also amazing chefs that work alongside Gavin. I think that it would be a huge goal to achieve all that he has up there, but in a different way.
Right.
My own way.
No, for sure. I mean, how are you finding life in Houston so far? I mean, kind of getting to know people in the culinary community. I mean,
I love it. Everyone is super welcoming. They help each other out. Chris Shepherd was one of the most inviting, welcoming people ever to me. You know, I remember I was down visiting my wife's family over Christmas, and I just texted him and Nick Wong, and they're like, "Oh, come on over to Goodnight Charlie's tonight." And next thing I know, we're having beers and watching a live band, and man, things couldn't be better. I was like, "This is awesome," it's just more and more stories like that. Being a part of Star Chefs down here was really great to sort of get an opportunity to mingle it with everyone and get to know people. I mean, I do know Nick Wong from New York. I knew him when we were both line cooks, when me at Cafe, him at Sambar. And then actually know Drake Leonard's also really well too, because him and I worked at Cafe Blue together 10 years ago when I first started. I actually took his spot on the soup station there when I first got there, and he moved to pasta. So it's, the transition's been great. I'm just so thankful for everyone for being so welcoming.
All right. Well, and I can't let you get out of here without at least asking you about The Final Table, your stint on reality television. I really enjoyed that show just because it was really all about the food. Like, there was no backstory. There was like very little of those like confessional type interviews. It was just like, here's a badass kitchen. Here's world-class ingredients. Like, go and make the best possible thing you can.
Yeah. Hey, I had a great time on it. I learned a lot. I learned that television is a lot harder than we all think. There's a lot that goes into it. I think they did a really great job. The producers came to us with this idea for a reality show that was as far away from what we had seen in reality cooking shows thus far, because, you know, you got to create drama, and to them the drama was in us creating our dishes on time and making sure it came out right. And you know, they were going to bring in incredible talent from around the world, and getting to meet some of those chefs was amazing. I think they were a little frustrated when we all didn't create more drama. You know, I think that was the producers, and I felt like they really had a tough task because when you see really good chefs working, they put their heads down and they don't talk much, and it's whatever communication is very small and quick, and you know, you're back on focused on your job, and you had to be to get whatever we had up in an hour. And I just thought it was funny that that it was, but no, I agree with you. How it came out, how it translated to actual television was great. If you really love the craft, it was something that was fun to watch for sure.
Yeah, they didn't have like the mechanisms to like create a villain or like all the usual, or you know, there wasn't like hot Cheetos or like tiny pans, you know, all the stupid gimmicks that you see in a lot of in some of the other shows.
Yeah, no, there wasn't. And to me, that was great, because it was an opportunity for us to showcase, you know, what we love doing. And that's cooking under pressure and making something great right before everyone's eyes. So it was fun for sure.
So are you good on TV or you know, do you aspire to do anything else? Or are you good?
I'm good. I like running restaurants more. I like, it's just too much sitting around when you do TV. It's what I love about a restaurant is There's always something to do, something pressing, something that needs to be taken care of. And you're just, your day, you literally start off by walking in and you're swept away and the rest, it just flies by, right? To TV, it's like, all right, let's stop. Let's get the lighting right. Camera, are we good? And then, you know.
Right. Boom is in the shot. You know, you gotta keep the mic out of there.
Yeah, exactly. So complicated. Goes forever, and then you feel like you accomplished nothing. But you know, it's different.
Well, Aaron, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. The I can't let you get out of here without the lightning round. Five easy questions, five short answers. Just say the first thing that comes to mind. Aaron Bluedorn, what is your favorite ingredient?
Mushroom.
What is the first band you ever saw in concert?
Silverchair.
What is your fast food guilty pleasure? It has to come from a restaurant with a drive-thru.
Dick's.
I asked people for their favorite Houston sports figure. That might be a little premature for you. Do you have a favorite Seattle sports figure, past or present?
Ken Griffey Jr., man.
I would have accepted Marshawn Lynch, maybe, or I don't know, Steve Largent, but yes, Ken Griffey Jr. is a great answer.
There we go.
And then, and finally, when you go to a pizzeria for the first time, what are your go-to toppings?
Go-to toppings. Wow, that one actually stumped me. Olives and sausage.
All right. Aaron, give us the website and social media for Bluedorn.
Okay. Bluedornrestaurant.com. Bluedorn, at Bluedorn ATX, HTX on Instagram. And at Aaron Bluedorn for my Instagram. There you awesome. Go.
Thank you.
Eric, thanks so much. That was a blast.
Thanks, man. You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. And as I've said now 150 times, I'll be back next week. One foot in front of the other, you know, one week after the next, eventually you get, you know, one episode, 10 episodes, 50 episodes, 100 episodes, 150 episodes.
It's true.
You know what happens before 150 episodes?
What's that?
149 episodes.
Well said.